This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No! Oh my God! How could he do that?
Are you on
drugs?
What?
Charles Darwin.
Welcome everybody back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Brebber, and alongside me is Logan Camden, and we are coming off of a wild couple of days in basketball, so we've got plenty of good stuff to talk about as the second round series wrap up, but unfortunately, with all that good basketball, there has also been some unfortunate news packaged with that. The Kawhi Leonard ACL injury, and we do not know the exact extent of that yet, but it seems like it may be a full-on tear, which obviously would keep him out of the picture deep into next season. The news of Chris Paul testing positive for COVID, and so now he has to go through those protocols. All of that is just on the tail end of a flurry of injuries that have plagued these entire playoffs, from Mike Conley obviously being unavailable throughout this series, Anthony Davis getting injured and really taking the Lakers out of the picture, Jamal Murray getting injured way back when for the Nuggets and really eliminating them from contender status, Embiid playing through a torn MCL, DeAndre Hunter being out for the Hawks. It feels like every team has been significantly impacted in one way or another, and I don't think that we can ignore the shortened offseason and its impact in that, and obviously having to come off of the bubble experience and then quickly turn around. But Logan, I guess I'll just ask you first off, what is the significance of all that, and what does it tell us about whoever ultimately comes out of this whole thing as the champion?
That we might have an asterisk at the end of this where guys are going to, you know, say this wasn't a completely, I'm not going to say earned title, but yeah, I think it's what we're going to have. If Kawhi doesn't play, like, I don't give the Clippers any chance at coming away with this title. People, and although they still could get out of this series, I mean, basically any team that's going to come out of the West is probably going to be decently flawed. I'm hoping that Chris Paul is back to full health, and that will be the closest to a fully healthy team that we have. But yeah, I just think that people are going to throw a lot of caveats at whoever wins this championship if it's not the Nets. Due to the circumstantial injuries. I just want to confirm, though, I hadn't heard I heard Kawhi was out indefinitely, but they're thinking it's an ACL injury.
Yeah, it is an ACL injury, and they just don't know if it's a tear or not yet. So that is obviously scary stuff for them, but I think that at the end of the day, the asterisk thing is always interesting, I guess, but you can put an asterisk on a lot of titles. Last year, I don't think you can, which is part of what's so funny to me about everybody saying it was the asterisk title. The year before that, I think you have a much better case with, obviously, the Raptors beating a depleted Warriors team. But at this point, we've almost leveled the playing field. I mean, if you're not playing with a significant player out, one of your two or three best players, you're the exception. So I think that we're going to see who was best equipped to handle that? And maybe it's a team like the Nets that obviously stocked up on reserves for a situation like this where they can play without one of their three superstars and still have a top two guys offensively that is better than probably anybody else in basketball. And so that's kind of what it's going to come down to, is who can survive that and weather the storm, and then also who gets lucky a little bit, right? Because if you are the Sixers and you're fully healthy, or you're the Bucks and the guy you're missing is Dante DiVincenzo, Sixers aren't fully healthy, but their star guy is still playing very well despite an injury, you are obviously more fortunate than the Clippers, the Nuggets, the Jazz even, the Suns, assuming that CP is not able to quickly clear those protocols. But I'm not leaning towards putting an asterisk on this just because it's been so universal, and we'll see how it all plays out. I'm more just bummed because I was more excited for these playoffs than I have been pretty much any playoffs in recent memory because of the depth of contenders, because of the fact that you could look and say, wow, there are five teams out west that I think could get to the finals, and there are three teams out east that are better than a top three that we've had in recent memory. And we're still having great basketball, but I think that we could have had even better basketball at full strength. And as we near the end here, I just want to make sure that we don't lose any more players and that we can sustain the level of basketball that we're even at right now. So it's just kind of been a bummer. And obviously, we'll never have to go through the short offseason circumstances again, but I do think that it has pretty clearly come back to haunt all of these teams down the stretch, because this is just a thoroughly abnormal number of injuries. I can't remember this ever happening.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It's a massive bummer anytime you don't have the best teams and the best players out on the floor. So now that you said that, though, I want to briefly touch on, I know we discussed this in the past, like, do you think that the NBA should have handled things a little bit differently this offseason, knowing what we know now?
I don't know that they had all that much of a choice. I think that they had to find a way to get the 2019-20 season done, and then that they had to find a way to get this season done without permanently altering the schedule, because they were still gunning to get back to that October start, which they now have confirmed that they have. And so we will be dealing with, again, a slightly abbreviated offseason this time around, but they're still going to have 3 months instead of 70 days for the shortest teams coming off of the bubble. But not every team went that deep. So this is going to be another short offseason now that I really am thinking about it. And you hope that it doesn't have any of the same problematic effects, because the NBA is not supposed to be the NFL. You're not supposed to lose a significant amount of stars to injury every year. And the NBA is so much more dependent on its stars than the NFL is, where it's more about the team brand and all of that. This is a league defined by stars being out there and being healthy, and that's part of what makes it so compelling. And so anytime you lose that, it's really unfortunate, especially in a year where there's so much parity at the top. There was so much uncertainty, so many possibilities, and there still is. And there's no doubt about that. It's going to be fun down the stretch, and I'm not going to sit here and whine about it forever, but I do feel like we need to touch on the fact that it is at least suboptimal given what we were expecting, and that this is a really established trend at this point that you can't just ignore. So with that sort of big picture stuff out of the way, let's get into the actual basketball of it here, because we saw one of those teams that has been affected by injury get out with a miraculous win in Game 5. That was the Brooklyn Nets over the Milwaukee Bucks, who also have been affected by injury. They don't have Dante DiVincenzo right now. I mean, this has literally touched every team remaining. What did that win tell you, Logan, and what are you expecting from here on out in this series?
I mean, it reinforced some things that we already know. The Nets are a nightmare to close against, and that the Bucks are just untrustworthy in these big moments. I mean, and I think it was a valid question that I asked. I think KD reinforced my question. Is this the best KD we've ever seen? I know he played all 48 minutes. Mm-hmm. Damn, dude. I mean, KD can just serve up buckets to anybody. And what I loved even more is at the end of the game, man, it was strategic. It was surgical, their offense. Like, it was – KD was intentionally getting screen set so they would switch a Pat Connaughton on him, or even if PJ did stick with him, man, it really just didn't matter. Like, KD got to his spots at the end of that game to claw them back in there, knocking down tough mid-range pull-ups. But I think the more exciting thing to look at from KD's game is the playmaking that we saw from him. I mean, Harden helped out a little bit, 8 assists, didn't really shoot the ball well. He shot 1 of 10, I think, in the game. He missed 8 threes. Really didn't look like himself. KD played a genuine playmaking role in this team and did a great job. You know, he hit Bruce Brown with a nice pass off of a double towards the end of the game to get another tough bucket. And, I mean, had 10 assists on the night. He had to carry this offense and prove that he was capable in doing so. And then you just got a decent game from a guy like Jeff Green as well. Knocked down 7 three-pointers, had 27 points. It's just, I think the biggest thing to look at is that the Nets are a super dangerous team to close against just because of Kevin Durant. And when guys like Jeff Green are knocking down shots, when you are getting consistent production out of a Shamet, out of a Bruce Brown, you're just not going to win. And I think from the Bucks side of that, I'll let you take over, Carson, but Drew Holiday's not the guy. He's not. At the end of games, when you're relying on him again to knock down tough shots, the Bucks just can't close, and that is going to be their Achilles heel until they figure that out. Chris Middleton knocked down some tough shots to try to extend the lead. He hit a late three. It's not enough. There's just not enough scoring punch here late in games for the Milwaukee Bucks to be genuine contenders, and you're not going to beat the Nets in a late close-game situation. KD and these boys are going to get to their spots.
And that was always kind of the tiebreaker for me looking at this series. It's what's undone Milwaukee time and again is that crunch time offense. Durant obviously was otherworldly in this one. Coming into this game, his playoff career highs were 50, 19, and 10. He had 49, 17, and 10 in this game alone on 16 of 23 shooting, along with 3 steals and 2 blocks. Just multifaceted impact, as you mentioned, was dissecting teams with his playmaking, and obviously as unstoppable as ever with the pull-up game. Just utterly lethal, getting to the line as well, getting easy points there. But I think what's pretty wild about this game is that Milwaukee played fine. They shot better than 40% from three, and Giannis had 34, 12, and 4 on efficient scoring, and Middleton wasn't the most efficient, but he still got his 25. Holiday had his 19. Lopez had his 15. And if you look at what happened for Brooklyn, Harris had another off night. He was 2 of 11. Bruce Brown didn't really have a significant impact on this game offensively. James Harden, obviously, with 5 points on 1 of 10 shooting. That seems to be the formula with Kyrie Irving out for a convincing Milwaukee victory. And obviously, KD ensured that that didn't happen. And Jeff Green ensured that that didn't happen. And Blake ensured that it didn't happen. And guys stepped up. But it's still pretty remarkably concerning for Milwaukee that you can't win that game, especially when you have it by the throat early and you're up 18. And I just think that going forward, my money is with the Nets to win this. I pledged my allegiance to them even after game 4, as irrational as it felt. I was just like, I kind of feel like they're going to find a way to win, and I really don't trust Milwaukee to win in these situations. And now I think that we are at the end of a 3-year trajectory for the Bucks, where as true contenders, year 1, you come out of the gates and you're so impressive in the regular season, and you have your budding superstar, your first time MVP, and you have your system that has delivered you the success, and you give it a go in the playoffs, and it doesn't work. You lose to a team that ends up winning the title, led by a just ethereal Kawhi Leonard. And so then you say, all right, let's run it back with the same squad, which I think is pretty natural. And then you run into some of the same issues again, regular season dominance, but then playoffs, you're undone by deliberately allowing so many threes, by having such a formulaic offense on your end, by not having that big-time closer, by Miami taking Giannis out of things for the second consecutive playoffs. And then you say, okay, we have to mix things up somehow. You get Drew Holiday, and now we have seen, as we kind of expected, that just was not a significant enough shakeup, and they tried to get Bogey before the year, ended up not doing it. And now I think that we are just inevitably and naturally at the blow-up point. And honestly, I would have been in favor of making major changes pretty much right away. My thought when we saw this first contending team was just that they are not going to be able to translate to playoff basketball. That has now proven true for 3 consecutive playoffs. Even if they win this series, Logan, it is meaningless to me because they are not winning the title. And if they somehow found a way to, it would be probably because they're the healthiest team out there, but they're not going to. I mean, there is no chance with how they're currently constructed. So we've touched on this before, but to me, it's just, you can only disappoint in the playoffs so many times until it stops becoming disappointing and just becomes the expectation. And that is 100% where we're at with Milwaukee.
Yeah, and I mean, there's adjustments that need to be made. They need to make roster adjustments. They need to move on from Coach Bud. They need to implement a different system. But I mean, can we really hold, I don't know, I'm just wondering, like, can we really hold these playoffs? It's just hard for me to hold this against them because it just seems like, I don't think any team's beating this Nets squad. Like, I just think that they inevitably just ran into the buzzsaw here.
I think a lot of teams are beating this Nets squad without Kyrie Irving when James Harden goes 1 for 10. Like, I think that the excuse of, oh, We are against the juggernaut expires when the juggernaut is missing a third and then another one of the superstar players looks nothing like himself out there. And yes, KD played the best game he ever has. But it's not just about that. I mean, the first two games of this series were hideous. Game three of this series, it was a miracle that they won, and they wouldn't have won against a fully healthy Nets team. And so now, here we are, and they're down again. And again, even if they win this series, I will be unimpressed.
And I'm not saying it's a good look. They had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter, and KD just didn't, you know, he got to his spots and it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. I'm not just like letting them off the hook. It's just, I don't know. Chris Middleton can't be your guy, bro. That's the takeaway here. You've got to get a better second guy for Giannis, in my opinion, bro.
Yeah. Go get Dame. Give up Drew. Hopefully the Blazers have some interest in that. I don't know. You kind of screwed yourself by giving up so many picks to get him. You just have to do something. You have to find a way, and you have to do more. You have to get that game-controlling point guard, that big-time closer who can elevate everybody around him, and so Giannis doesn't have to try to manufacture those point guard touches, because it's just beyond salvation at this point.
What do you think of my Giannis to the five take from a while back?
Yeah, I think that it's kind of a natural conclusion, because I think what you have to do is just start using him as a role man more and more. And the more shooting that's around him, the better. I will say, the bright side about having Brook Lopez there is that he's such a floor spacing big that it's not like you're losing shooting offensively. The majority of his attempts are going to come from deep anyways, so I don't think that they have a pressing need given this fit. I think that playing Giannis alongside a non-shooting center would be suicide, but that's not the case in Milwaukee. But I would be open to trying it at this point. Give it a shot. Defensively, I think that he certainly has the instincts to protect the rim. And by the way, as we saw with KD, his job is not to be put on the best perimeter defender. And that's part of the reason why I was very anti-Giannis for DPOY. It's that his value is as that rover, that help defender, that defensive playmaker, affecting other players' shots with his outstanding length. He could still do that as a rim protector. You'd definitely be losing something on the perimeter. But try it in stretches at the very least, and they've had success when they have tried it. So I think that let's move on to the Nets for a second here, because KD obviously put on a masterclass and had one of these signature performances of his career. What do you think it means for his resume if they can pull this out with, obviously, Kyrie going down with Harden in an afflicted state? Or are you not all that impressed because you still view them as the juggernaut, the buzzsaw? Where do you come down on that?
No, I think you're right. I don't think I should have phrased it that way. After contextualizing, I think this is much, it is much more impressive for KD. And I think the most impressive thing from this last game is 48 minutes. KD was on the floor just every second of this game. I mean, that's extremely impressive, not just for the not just for the plain fact that KD has had struggles with staying healthy, but that's tough, man. It means that you're hungry and that you care. And KD knew that they couldn't lose this game, because if you go down 3-2, and I think this is another interesting scenario that we'll have to talk about with Atlanta and Philly, just it affords them a cold shooting night from a Jeff Green, from a Joe Harris. You know, like, KD knew that they had to pull this one out to make sure that they win the series, and I think they will go on, whether it's 6 or 7. It affords them a gap game, so to speak. But no, this is a extremely impressive feat for Kevin Durant. If Harden and Kyrie were healthy and out putting theirs up, we wouldn't care. We could have said this is what we expected to have happen. And with Kyrie going down, with Harden looking like a shell of himself in the minutes that we did see out there, no, it is extremely impressive for KD. And I will say, not that the Bucks are overwhelmingly talented, but yeah, basically by himself taking down the squad, it's one of the more impressive playoff feats, just because KD had to do it by himself and didn't have overwhelming talent alongside him. Where do you straddle this fence?
I think that it's remarkable, and there's no question about that. And yeah, guys made big shots in game five alongside him, the Jeff Greens and Blake Griffins of the world again, but that was as good of a one-man show as I can remember seeing in a long time. And I think that he is making his best player in the world case. And I think that that's what's so fascinating about this season, is with the variety of teams that have made their case as the best in the league and the deserved championship favorite and all of that, maybe a fully healthy Nets team would have been the overwhelming favorite beginning to end, but we just haven't seen that fully healthy Nets team, with the exception of 10 games basically this entire year. But I think that you can point to a group of guys who have gone out there and made that best player in the world case. From Jokic, obviously, having, in my opinion, the greatest offensive season of any big man ever, to KD putting up now 33-9-4.5 on 52-43-89 splits. Throw LeBron into that conversation, really just out of reverence for what he's done. I mean, he didn't get to that level in the playoffs, but maybe that's partly impacted by injury. I'm not removing him from the discussion entirely. I think a lot of people would tell you with Luka having one of the greatest playoff series really in a loss ever and commanding the game like he did and shooting that remarkably from beyond the arc. The guy puts up 36-8-10 on 41% from deep. I would hear a case for him. I think that Kawhi is making a case, surprisingly. I didn't think that he would, but we again see him play his best basketball in the postseason. He's up at 38-4 on 57-39-88 splits, praying that he does return. The Clippers are apparently hopeful that it's not that bad, so that would be fantastic, but I would expect them to be hopeful because it'd be kind of weird if they weren't. So what are we at now? Five? And I didn't even mention Joel Embiid, who I think has absolutely made a case as well, just with his two-way impact, obviously, and his relentlessness as a scorer, and in this series against the Hawks has been utterly dominant. So a little bit of a tangent there, but I just think it's crazy. I would have told you coming into the playoffs, I thought Jokic is the best player in the world. Actually, maybe I would have said LeBron. Then after the first round, I would have said Jokic. And now I think Kevin Durant is yet again making his case and maybe is as good as he's ever been, just with the playmaking evolution, with what he's doing defensively right now. And that scoring is not going to go away for a long time. So is there anyone else who I didn't mention who you think has made a best player in the world case? Is there anybody who I mentioned who you think doesn't quite belong in that conversation? Because I'm not saying that I would make a strong argument for every single one of them, but I could see somebody making an argument for pretty much every single one of them.
I would say, I mean, I agree with all the guys you laid out. I would just say that my top two right now are, I think, by far Kawhi and KD. And I want to say the number, the big number from this playoffs has been, I don't know, it's like Kawhi, I don't think Kawhi missed in the fourth quarter in this series against Utah or something insane like that. Literally just had not missed from the field.
Yeah.
Just unreal in clutch time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these are the two signature shot makers in the game right now. And that's what they have been for nearly a half decade now. And that's why alongside LeBron, it felt like they were always just slotted into those second and third best guy slots. And then the talent around the league has just evolved to the point where now we have these scoring playmaking hybrids like a Jokic, like a Luka, that we just didn't have in this kind of abundance before. I mean, it was Harden and LeBron, and they were kind of the two. And now it feels like that number is extending every day, even to guys like Trey, who aren't at that level as a player, but a pretty insane player who can produce at such a high level in both of those categories. And so you think those guys have more overall impact on offense, and maybe they do night to night, but there is still something that is really tough to match about just the ruthless killing scorer who can also do so with mind-bending efficiency and who has evolved to be more than competent as a playmaker. KD was phenomenal playmaking in this past game. And the game is just in an incredible place right now where we have this many guys who are this great in this variety of ways. And that was kind of part of my takeaway from that KD masterpiece. Doesn't matter for his longtime legacy. I don't know that people are going to remember the exact circumstances of him winning this series against the Milwaukee Bucks. But I will say, when you are north of 30 coming off of an injury that for many people effectively ends their career, for almost everybody in NBA history, and you are making a case for best player in the world again, and you very well may be the best player on a title team yet again, that is when it starts to all come together and is packaged as a real legacy-altering moment, legacy-enhancing moment. And I think that that very well may be in store for KD.
My final Bucks Nets question for you, Carson. Who are you putting on KD the rest of the series? You want PJ or Giannis?
That's a tough question. I would go Giannis, personally. I mean, I think that you put the best athlete who has the most length on him and just say, let's try to affect him however we can. Let's try to keep him off his spots. Maybe PJ's better at that because he's strong and a little bit more physical than Giannis, but at least get a hand in his face that is, I don't know, prevalent enough to maybe affect him a little bit, but you're not affecting KD. You're just not. He is, along with Michael Jordan, the most unaffectable scorer in the history of this game. And at the end of the day, you're just going to go out hoping that he misses some shots that he normally makes, because otherwise, you know, you're just going to die. And I don't really think that there's all that much you can do to make him uncomfortable. What do you think? Who are you going with?
No, I'm going with Giannis all day. I just wanted a, you know, another rational human being. Maybe we could pass a message along to Coach Bud. Maybe he could figure it out. I just, KD's been making PJ look like a fool all series long, and I'm tired of people acting like, I'm not saying PJ's not a good defender, but it's KD, bruh. Like, you're asking a 36-year-old with shoe game to come out there and try to defend the best scorer on planet Earth. Like, I think it's been a foolish matchup ever trying it. I think they should have had Giannis on KD every possession until a switch comes.
Well, maybe you can throw that into the Firebud campaign that started earlier in this series, and I think is kind of inevitable at this point. And if they do hold on to Bud, and if they do just run it back with the same core, the same exact core, the same top three guys, then shame on Milwaukee, because this is just not good enough. We've seen time and again that it's just not good enough. And it's not like they just haven't had enough cracks at it and they're waiting to break through. They have been beaten by vulnerable teams, teams they are better than on paper, all of this stuff. And there are clear, tangible reasons why this drops off. And there's a clear, tangible reason why Giannis is not in that best player in the world discussion and has never been for me. And I thought that it was ludicrous when he was, because a guy who scores 8.2 transition points a game, all of a sudden, you can't get that kind of offense. All of a sudden, you aren't your team's best closer. All of a sudden, a team gives you all the runway in the world and you start taking threes and turnarounds that you just can't make. A player who can be exposed that easily with a weakness that prominent cannot be the best player in the world, in my humble opinion, with the game in the state that it is, where all of these guys are so well-rounded for the most part and so thoroughly dominant. So, all right. What are your final expectations with this series before we move on? Are you feeling that Brooklyn pulls this out in seven?
Yeah, I'm going to go Brooklyn in seven. I'd like to go Brooklyn in six, but I can't imagine that KD comes back in this next game. And I'm not saying gives it his all. He's going to play his ass off. But just after a performance like that, 48 minutes, I don't think that we're going to see that same level of production. If there's a good shooting night from alongside the Nets core, I think they can win it. But I'm expecting a light game from Harden, maybe a little off shooting from some other guys, and the Bucks eke out a win. But I think the Nets take it in seven.
Yeah, I think the Nets take it in seven, too. And Reggie Miller might advise that they just immediately let it go there and they sit out all their guys for game six. That was a brilliant idea from Coach Reggie on the Twitter sphere. I think that anytime you get down to game seven, there are a bunch of variables that can swing a game. Obviously, just who shoots better from three, who has the most energy that night. I mean, there's so many things that can go into it, but I am going to lean on the team with the better big time shot making, with the best player unequivocally, with the two best players, in my opinion, and I am not going to waver in that faith. So I did say that I was worried about the Nets offense flowing without Kyrie and talked about how much it stagnated in that game four and saying KD was not that kind of single offensive engine with the scoring playmaking combo. He was in this game, and he may not even have to do it to this extent again, assuming that Harden is something more like himself. So it's a scary combination for Milwaukee, and they are probably going to be sent packing pretty soon yet again. So with that, let's move on to the other series out east, where we saw an equally remarkable game five in which the Sixers were up by 26. They were up by 22 at the half, and they let it slip away. The Hawks just kept coming. They win the fourth quarter by 21 points. They entered the fourth down 18. What do we make of this?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, I think, in this series. The first is two back-to-back colossal just choke jobs. 18 points in game five, 26 in this last game, like you, or excuse me, 18 in game four, 26 in game five, like you said. And I'm going to harken back to a video that you made. The Hawks are terrifying when they're hitting shots. Like you said, they outscored them by 21 on 16 of 22 shooting. Something I said in an earlier podcast that we shot, Lou Williams had to be a big part of this team for them to eke out some wins here. He had 13 points in the fourth quarter and they needed it. But there's a weird thing that's happening in Philly, Carson, that I didn't expect to really be an issue. And that's just, I mean, we briefly touched on it, but I didn't expect it to be a major focal point of their playoff run. And that's they did just not get reliable offense out of anybody, out of Embiid and Seth Curry. And in this last game, Embiid and Curry were the only Sixers to hit a field goal in the second half. And it's weird. In the third quarter, Carson, I just remember distinctly watching with them with their over 20-point lead. They're still running plays. They're still running offense. It looks like the Sixers are just going to completely run away with this one. And I wrote the Hawks off. I turned the game off. I laid down. My dad comes back in here with, you know, like 5 minutes left. Hey, the Hawks are coming back. Mm-hmm. And it's just disappointing. Going back and watching it, I think there's a few issues that we can point out. Simmons and Embiid's struggles from the free throw line, but I think the biggest thing is just you don't have another ball handler that can knock down shots. Ben Simmons is the issue. And he's been like, I don't know if you turn to Shake Milton, Tyrese Maxey. I don't think the Sixers have enough offense to get out of the East. And I don't know, man. You've made me come around, Carson. You need a lot of offensive creators and contributors in the playoffs, and that's why the Hawks are a better playoff team than the Sixers. In late-game situations, that really solid defense can go out of the window when guys are knocking down shots, and the Sixers just don't have enough shot makers to make a deep playoff run. And Seth Curry has been tremendous. I don't want to downplay what he has done in this series. Seth Curry has been unreal with the ball in his hands, off of screens, off of plays. The Sixers don't have enough creators. That is my big takeaway.
Well, what have I been saying, Logan? This whole time I've been saying that obviously their shortcoming as a contender is that lack of reliable offensive firepower from a number of sources. And what's so concerning for them is you're down 3-2 when Embiid has, with the exception of game four, been pretty phenomenal and is putting up 32, 13, and 5 on 37% from deep, is getting to the free throw line every other trip down. But more than that, when Seth is putting up 21 a game on 58% from three, him and Reggie Jackson are obviously on another planet right now, him even more so. When Seth Curry can play as your second best offensive player and you still are down to a team that you probably have more talent on paper than, that to me is just the epitome of what will be their undoing, even if they do get out of this series. And they could get out of the next series if it's Milwaukee, not if it's Brooklyn, though. They just cannot hang in a shootout with a team of that caliber, and that is why I've been so skeptical of this team all year long. And now it feels like they're kind of at a crossroads too, and this is the best team by far that they've put around the Embiid and Simmons core. But you mentioned it, Simmons is another guy whose value just diminishes in the playoffs, and this is now a clearly established pattern again, where this is the third time around that we've seen it. And when you see something three times, then you kind of just know it to be true. And when a guy doesn't have any value as that closing force, when he can be dismantled, taken out of the game as a scorer, when things slow down, he doesn't have that transition value anymore, he can just kind of fall to pieces. And I don't know that he is a capable enough second guy to be on a title team. Even though Embiid, I think, again, has made a case for best player in the world, is probably somewhere in that top five, if not right outside of it. He has been tremendous here, playing through injury even. And Seth has been great. Toby has been fine. He had a pretty bad game in this last one, but was pretty good before then. But there's one guy who just has not shown up to have that impact, and I think really just needs to be a third guy somewhere. Because defensively, the impact is tremendous, obviously, and offensively, the playmaking impact can be significant, but you just can't have that kind of offensive burden on him, and he doesn't have it here. He doesn't even have the expectations, but it's part of the reason why they don't have enough firepower to hang here.
And I hate to bag on the guy even more, but I mean, even if you could just hit a free throw, you may have come away with both of these last games. He missed too late that, I mean, the Hawks immediately go down and hit a three. Like, you're just giving away points at that point. And I want to give Embiid all the credit in the world for playing through this injury and working hard. But there were a few plays from 2 games ago. Embiid goes 0 of 12 from the field in the second half. I am going to make him wear that, even though he was clearly struggling with that injury. Mm-hmm. And late in the game yesterday, Embiid is driving down. I believe at this point in the game, they're down 2 or 3. He drives to the bucket on the left side, and he's going to put up a layup, it looks like. Gets positioning, gets leverage. He's stronger than Clint Capella. He looks like he's going to go up with it. And he tries to throw a pass under the backboard to Tobias Harris that just goes out of bounds. You can't be passive in those moments. You just listed him as one of the best players in the world, Carson. And in those moments, you have positioning under the board. You're strong enough. You're going to knock down this layup. Why are you trying to kick the rock to Tobias Harris? Go up strong, Joel. Like, they turn the ball over. The Hawks go and score on the other end, and it didn't end the game. There was still about a minute left for them to make something happen, but it really swung the momentum all the way over to Atlanta after that turnover. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's something that can't happen out of your star player in those big moments. And it's not like this has been consistent. This is just one moment, but I want Embiid putting up all of those late mm-hmm. shots, and I can't have him pass that rock in that moment when you have a clear path to the paint. That was just a sad moment that I think could have – it gets you another 2 points. It cuts the lead to one. It makes this a little bit easier on you. I can't have Embiid be passive in these big moments.
And he did miss a painful layup attempt to try to tie game four as well when he had a pretty good look at it right-handed. And I think that obviously they have – developed a weird situation as far as who's the closer because Embiid is so skilled that he can be that scorer out of the post. And I'm not going to say that it doesn't work because I think that we've seen it work, but maybe a couple of shortcomings there, even if he's been pretty great for the first 40-something minutes of these games. And I'm not going to criticize Embiid either. I mean, he is far from the problem here. And what remains interesting is if you look at the Simmons-Embiid minutes, they are still dominant here. I mean, in the playoffs, they're still putting up an offensive rating of 129, a defensive rating of 106.3. That's a net rating of 22.6. I mean, that's the best of any volume two-man lineup pretty much for the Sixers. So it continues to seem that that duo in itself is not the problem on paper in some ways, but it just feels weird. And I mean, they don't compare to contenders in a lot of other ways, and I would say it's notably beyond those two, the lack of creators and the lack of really game-changing depth. And the fact that they have to rely on guys who are, in a lot of situations, hot and cold, a Shake Milton, a Tyrese Maxey coming in those situations, a guy like Tease, who's going to have his remarkable defensive impact but isn't going to be reliable to knock down shots, Furkan, who can make his shots but is pretty one-dimensional, and if he isn't, is pretty much useless out there. Like, they just have a much more flawed supporting cast. But what do you think? Are we making excuses? Is it time to move on from the Simmons-Embiid duo? And I hate to just have that same old conversation, but like, this has been, I think, another condemnation of playoff Ben Simmons and what he's capable of.
Yes, you are exactly right. I was just talking to my dad about this, bro. It's time to blow it up. And I know we always say that about damn near everything. Just move Simmons. And I think you can get a ton of value for Ben, man. I think you can fleece a dumb team. Like, I don't know who the ideal partner if you – just somebody who can handle the rock and knock down a jumper, bro. Like, I know we always, Colin Cowherd, I remember, pulled this out in 2018, bro. Let's trade Chris Paul to the Rockets. Trade Chris Paul to the Sixers and we move Ben Simmons to the Rockets. I know it's boring. It's tired. A player like Chris Paul is obviously the perfect fit alongside Embiid. We need another ball handler who can knock down a shot. And yeah, move on. It doesn't work. And it's, I don't know, bro. And I hate saying this, Ben Simmons, like you said, Carson, can be a valuable piece somewhere. He cannot be a – I don't know if Ben Simmons can ever be a guy that wins in the playoffs until he can become, until he starts knocking down his shots. And that is why I wouldn't – I don't know if I'd even want him on my roster getting 38 minutes in a playoff game. I don't know if I'd want him on my team. But long story short, yeah, to sum this up, yes, it's been time for Philly to move on.
So do you think they can get a significant haul from him for a team who has anybody worth getting? Because you're saying a dumb team, but most of the dumb teams are kind of dwelling in the cellar and they don't necessarily have somebody they want. Because I think, as you said, it has to be that elite perimeter shot creator. I guess it doesn't have to be, but it would certainly be nice if you could find a way to get a Dame. And I'm throwing in whatever with Simmons, but I just worry that his value has depreciated to the point where I don't know that he can even be a centerpiece of a deal like that.
It may very well have been, especially after it's not just been this one year. He's had multiple playoff woes. He's had woes his entire career. I don't know. I'm even going to throw out if you can somehow swing a Bradley Beal trade, maybe. I know that's really hopeful, and I don't think the Wizards would budge on that, but that's a really good question. It would have to be I don't think you can throw like Thibault. It's got to be like Simmons and Milton, Simmons and Maxey. I think that's the only way you're able to swing a deal, maybe a pick as well. But no, I think his value has diminished, and I think you're going to have to throw in a decent amount to go actually and swing up and get a shooting superstar.
I'm willing to throw in Thibault, man. I think that there comes a point where you just have to sacrifice the elite defense and understand that offense wins championships at this point. And you're still going to be a very good team defense, even if you lose one or two of those individual cogs, because you have a great rim protector, you have a culture that's established where guys care about that end, compete on that end, and you need to have the firepower to therefore justify all of that effort and make yourself a team that can actually win a title. Because I've never thought the Sixers were that this year, and you can go back to when we ranked our contenders. I had the Sixers and the Bucks, I guess it was 7th and 8th, despite their standing as the top two teams in the East at that point. And I think that has been justified by how we've seen them undone in these playoffs. But enough about Philly, man. Let's talk about the team opposite them that is continuing their remarkable run, the terrifying Atlanta Hawks, as you said. And I think that let's talk about the specifics of how they've done it, of what we're expecting from them going forward. But first off, I just need to give a nod to the willpower and the identity of a team that is able to come back from deficits like this in back-to-back games. A guy like Trey, who is able to will himself to big stat lines at the end of the day, to have that pronounced playmaking scoring impact, even without shooting the ball all that efficiently, just keeps coming. I think that this has been a remarkable testament. I mean, the ability of a guy like John Collins to fight on the glass offensively. These guys are just fighting. They keep on coming. And what do you think? How far can this team take it? And do you think they end up getting out of this series?
Man, I want to pick Atlanta after this last game. Obviously, I like them offensively. And I think we saw a lot of really positive things in this last game. The biggest one to me is in those fourth quarter minutes. I don't like shying away from Bogey. Bogey had had a slow game. They turned to Lou Williams, and Lou was hot. And that is why if you get a Lou Williams that's on fire, I think that the Hawks can win this next game and be done with this series. The big reason that I like Lou more is obviously Gallo was good. I don't want to disrespect Gallo. He knocked down some tough mid-range jumpers. He was hitting his threes as well when he had his touches. I don't like volume Gallo touches late. So when you have somebody that can take the pressure off of Bogey or Gallo, I love it. I just don't know how consistent Lou will. Lou Will just hasn't been consistent. So I don't know if he's going to bring that in this next game. And because they need that scoring punch, in my opinion. Yeah. I'm going to ride. We're going to – do I hedge my bets again, bruh? Do I hedge my bets? Yeah. Like, I love the Hawks so much more offensively.
Go Atlanta, man. Get on the train. I'm going Atlanta here. And I think I've been talking about how they would have a puncher's chance in this series for probably longer than most. And my initial pick was Sixers and seven. And I think just what it comes down to is a few things. The Hawks haven't played their best basketball over the last couple games. And they have been down and out. And they have still found a way to win. And we haven't seen that uber efficient Trey game that we saw in game one in a few games. We haven't seen that Bogey explosion that you would expect, with the exception of maybe, I don't remember what game it was. There was one where he was over 20. But for the most part, he's been pretty spotty in this series, which you don't really expect from him. And then on the opposite side of that, Philly again has had their best player play like their best player, has had Seth Curry with this just astronomically great performance, and they are the team that is now down on the ropes. And game four was an anomaly for Atlanta winning because Embiid was so bad. Atlanta turned the ball over four times. Like, stuff like that is not going to happen again. But I also think that game five, they were able to win without playing their best basketball. And part of that is, as you mentioned, just the variety of contributors, man. And Lou is not a guy who I want to trust to play 25 minutes night to night. They don't have to, though. And when they needed him to, he was able to step up and deliver in a big way. And guys like Gallo, I was pretty confident when he took that tough little face-up jumper to ice the game almost in game five. I was like, you know what? That's a Gallo shot. And all he does is make tough shots, because all he does is take tough shots. So he'll probably hit it. And Herter, obviously, when he was going, he wasn't so great in this last game, but is a guy who can make big shots. Like, this has been the appeal of this Atlanta team all along. They have the offensive superstar, and they have the pieces around him who reliably make this machine go and can change the game in their own ways. And I think that John Collins has been phenomenal in this series and deserves the utmost credit, because he's shooting the ball pretty well. I mean, he's giving you 17 a game on 56% shooting, but it, to me, really has been the ability to fight on the offensive glass. And he had a couple frustrating possessions down the stretch in this last one where he's taken face-up jumpers, he's taken threes instead of rolling to the bucket hard, being that lob threat. But you know what? He probably earned it by fighting like he did on the glass. And I just think this is a great team that knows who they are. And I think that they have maybe kind of broken the will of Philly. Embiid is not going to go away. It seems like Seth Curry, remarkably, is not going to go away, but he is due for a cold game at some point. But I don't know how the rest of this Philly team recovers, and I just don't think they have the depth of difference makers. So this is remarkable here that Trae Young, a guy who last year was being derided as an empty stats player, who I spent more time complaining about how he played than I did lauding the level of talent that he was. Here he is now, captaining this ship. And yes, he hasn't been his best, but he's been good enough, and he's found a way to, again, keep on coming. And this is a special Atlanta team that obviously has integrated some of the veteran talent, but they're still really young, man. I mean, the majority, or at least a significant chunk of this team's best players, especially when DeAndre Hunter is out there, are under 25. And that's another thing. They're doing it without DeAndre Hunter, their best perimeter defender, and a guy who will give you a reliable 16, 17 a game offensively. Like, this is just crazy stuff that we are seeing from Atlanta. So I think they're going to pull it off too.
Yeah, and we've been able to see some Onyeka minutes too, Carson.
Yeah. No, Onyeka's been interesting.
That's the next most appealing thing I think you brought up, bruh. How young this roster is. Like, and these pieces are going to be, I'm not saying that they're going to be interchangeable. When you got a guy like Trae Young, man, I think that plug and place are going to be pretty easy. Basically, this Hawks team is going to be good for, they're probably going to be in this spot every year as long as Trae's healthy for the next decade.
Yeah. And maybe they need a more true second star than Bogey if they want to be that real championship level team. I would say that they do. But Bogey is good enough as the second guy to carry you pretty far, especially when, again, in an individual game, Collins can be your second guy, Gallo can be your second guy, a healthy Hunter can be your second guy. Like, there's just a depth of options that Philly can't match, and most teams in this league can't match. So I am all in on the ATL train here, and I wish I had picked them. I mean, I think that it would have been a little overly gutsy, but I was so high on them as a team and not quite as high on Philly as a team, and this is remarkable what they're doing. And I will remind us all that in the regular season, the Sixers were 35-7 when Simmons and Embiid both played together. And that is the team that Atlanta is beating right now. But also, Atlanta was 30-14 when Bogey was healthy. Also much better than their record. So we're seeing it all play out here. We're seeing a couple teams that were maybe more adversely affected in some ways by injuries in the regular season now be relatively healthy in the playoffs and play some really entertaining basketball because of it. And part of what's also so interesting about these Hawks series is just that because of their pace, I mean, we think of them as an offensive team, but they don't play fast, and so there's been a lot of games on the scoreboard that have been grinded out. The Knicks series was obviously a different beast, and they've played a couple great defensive teams, so I'm sure that that's part of it as well. But, like, there are a lot of games where they're barely eclipsing 100 points, and they're finding a way to win, like these last couple. So, just a great team. Any other thoughts on this series before we move on to the last one in Jazz Clippers? All right, so let's talk about what we saw between the Jazz and the Clippers in Game 5, which was another remarkable win. I mean, every Game 5 was pretty insane in its own way. The Clippers come out on top without Kawhi Leonard. Paul George was fantastic. Marcus Morris, yeah, eat your words on that one, Logan. He was fantastic. Reggie Jackson continued to be essentially Michael Jordan. What do we make of this? What are we expecting going forward?
They listen to you, Carson. They listen to you. To close out this game, they ran small ball 5 with Nick Batum out there, and he wet up a late shot on Rudy Gobert. This was a masterclass on how to close a game by Los Angeles, and people are going to give a lot of credit to Paul George. He deserves it. Reggie Jackson played out of his mind in that fourth quarter. He hits that tough jumper on Clarkson. Mm-hmm. He makes the open 3 to extend the lead. He blows by Gobert late to get that late bucket. Reggie balled out, and I don't know, man, if my biggest takeaways, if the Jazz don't get Mike Conley back, I think they're done. Like, obviously this wouldn't have been as close a game,
really,
if Donovan Mitchell had pulled his end and played better, but I think it's just a shortcoming that we have to accept now about this Utah roster is, yeah, you need Mitchell and Clarkson every night, and it's not reliable if you don't have a guard to make it to make everything work and go around. I think they need, we need more Ingles guard minutes out there with the rest of the unit. I know he's been closing, but I don't know, man. They need another creator, and I think they need Conley desperately. But anyway, back to the small ball 5-point, bro. Just every time the Jazz would come back, you know, they kick it to a roll on Gobert, they kick it in, they score a bucket. Whatever they did, because this was so back and forth late, you know, they were down, they cut the lead to 3 with 8 minutes left. And then the Clippers got it back up to 10 with 6 left. And I think it's a shortcoming with Gobert in the lineup defensively with how they stretch the floor. Like, the Clippers were just bombing threes late to keep that lead up, and Utah couldn't keep up. They kept getting twos, and they would extend it. You saw and this is also, Mitchell may not have had a great game. Clarkson may not have had a great game. Boyan played his ass off, hit 9 threes, had 32 points. Like, I don't know. It's just it's not a good look when the team's other best player is out. You get some nice bench support, and I mean, you make it close in the end, but I think the key that you pointed out, Carson, has been the biggest, is that that small ball 5 unit is absolutely deadly no matter who you're against, even more so when you have a perimeter liability like Rudy Gobert late.
Yeah, they've started to figure it out, and it's interesting to me that you have so much confidence in them to hold on here, because I think that this is really just going to come down to who shoots better, because both these teams are going to create good shots, and this has been one of the greatest shooting displays that we have seen in a playoff series, as you would have expected. You have the team that made the most threes per game in NBA history in the Jazz, and you have the team that shot the fourth best percentage from three in NBA history in the Clippers, and they have both delivered to expectations there. The Jazz are making, like, what is it, 18.6 threes a game on 41% shooting, and the Clippers are making 15.4 threes a game on 41.6% shooting. I mean, it's just unthinkable, and that is how the Clippers have managed and the Jazz have managed in some stretches to manufacture great offense without multiple traditional difference makers, more so the Clippers. They just have shot makers, and Reggie at this point has transcended and is having a kind of playoff run that, if they end up sealing the deal or even just getting to the finals, I think is kind of immortalized and defines his legacy. He's putting up 16 a game on 43.5% from deep in these playoffs, and we already sung his praises last show, but it's not just off the catch. I mean, he can create for himself too. And you mentioned that drive on Gobert. It was audacious. I still do not recommend that guards drive on Gobert when they get that switch. I think you shoot, you let him sag off a little bit, and then you pull it in his face, because that was a tough finish that he had, but he made it, man. And he is just playing the best basketball of his life. And you mentioned it. They have the rotation now. The Kennard minutes, the Terrence Mann minutes, running the small ball 5 when it matters, which is what they've been doing for the most part when it matters, but there's still been a little bit too much Zubats. I think that they figured it out for the most part, and they have a guy who is a great shot creator and a great bucket getter in Paul George, who has obviously come so far in his development, an elite shooter, a guy who can be effectively your point guard in stretches and has been for much of this year. But I still think that they're going to need to, again, shoot the ball really, really well, and they're going to need PG to be that big-time player, and they may need him to be a really transcendent closer. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're just going to keep going to the open man and knocking down threes all day, but if this is a really close game in Game 6, it's going to come down probably to a battle of him between Donnie, and that's a tough battle to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's going to come down to shooting, as it always does with these two teams, but I don't know, man. It looked really different last night. Like, the ease at which they were moving the ball around the perimeter. There were so many late rotations on Utah's side that we just don't traditionally normally see out of the squad. And maybe it was just an off game for Utah. Mitchell was off. Defensively, they didn't look right, and this was a close game. I don't know. This was just such an important win for Utah. Without Kawhi, you're missing Conley on your end. Like, I don't know. This is just one that they had to win. This is a big swing game. And if Kawhi's out again, maybe it's not as important, because instead of just having one game without Kawhi, you have three cracks at it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This felt like one that Utah really needed to win, though.
Yeah, and it's kind of the anti-game one for them, because game one, obviously, they go down big, and they're not knocking down their shots, and all of a sudden they start raining threes. Donnie goes insane. Boom, they find a way to win. This one, they make 17 threes in the first half on 50-something percent shooting, and then they let it slip away. And I will say, I think part of that does fall on Donnie, because for all the praise that we gave him deservedly for the first couple games and even games 3 and 4, finding a way to be highly productive if the efficiency slipped, he did not have it in game 5, and I think is veering on just playing too much hero ball here, because this is a team that is defined by moving the ball, by knocking down shots, all those things, and he is their best player, he is their best shot maker, and I literally made a YouTube video on why he elevates his game in the playoffs recently, and like he's still putting up 34 a game this series on 59% true shooting, pretty good efficiency, but there are spots where he's getting doubled, or he's just not able to blow by a guy, or he's forcing it. He tries to split a double, and he loses the handle a little bit. He barrels into traffic, and he loses control. And it just feels like the most reliable thing has been his perimeter shot. And then once he gets inside the arc, it's a little bit shakier. And he's taking tough threes, too. So those can't always go in. So I just worry a little bit too much about that right now. And that's where, as you mentioned, Conley coming back could be huge. But they have gotten big-time shot-making from other guys. Bojan was great. Ingles has been consistently great throughout this series with the exception of game one, and they still haven't found a way. So do you really think that the Clippers can do it without Kawhi? Like, are you just that confident in the machine creating those threes and knocking down the threes? Because honestly, I think it's reasonable. Part of me just wants to believe that the Jazz team we saw in this regular season with all their difference makers can find a way. But with these two teams, man, it really is just about who makes more of their threes at a better clip. And the Clippers have two shots to do that, and the Jazz only have, they have to do it consecutive times, whereas the Clippers just have to do it one out of two.
Yeah, and no, I think that's the big highlight. I think the Clippers can do it if Conley is out on the Jazz side. If Conley comes back and is fully healthy, I would probably lean the Jazz in these two games if the Clippers don't have Kawhi back. But I also think it comes down to what you're talking about with the shooting and late game scenarios, Carson. And this is not just meant to, you know, bag and bash Rudy Gobert, but he's a non-shooter in closing minutes. Do you not play Gobert in closing minutes? Like, he's a transcendent defender, but against a team like this, I don't know if he's even relevant to have on the floor.
I think you play him because who was the difference-making shooter who you are playing? Royce O'Neal and then Ingles, Clarkson, Bojan, and Mitchell? Like, I don't want Clarkson out there in closing minutes. I don't need, in my opinion, that other, like, reckless shot maker, which is what Jordan Clarkson is. I mean, he's shooting 38% from the field in this series, and it's kind of showing the double-edged sword of him and why, in my opinion, he shouldn't have been sixth man of the year, and it should have been Ingles, who has been a starter in this series because of Conley. But I think that you play Gobert, and you understand and live with the consequences there because it's not ideal. I mean, it's not an ideal closing five, but I don't know that there is one. I mean, unless it's George Niang, like, I just don't think that there is a counter unless, do you think it's Clarkson?
All right, bro. Like, I don't like you crapping on my boy like that. Like, I get it. Yeah, he is a reckless shot maker. He's kind of just
he's a wild man.
Yes, I would play Clarkson. I would play the wild man because he's better than a non-creator completely. I mean, like, the only what? Gobert's going to get you a rebound? It doesn't matter if he's getting dotted up by Nick Batum.
Yeah, I just think he still is a deterrent from the paint, and you can still run pick and roll with him relatively deep into the game. And yeah, maybe the last possession or two, you're right, he's not going to be that factor. But you know what? At least he can secure me a rebound. Like, I just don't think that you need that extra creator in those moments, unless it's a guy who I trust to make good decisions and to score the ball efficiently, like a Mike Conley. Clarkson has his big-time moments. He makes big-time shots, but it's a little bit too sketchy of a proposition to me with him every time. So we've talked about how we think that the Clippers can hold on here. Let's praise the guy who is the engine behind it. Like, yes, the Clippers are all making shots, but I noticed in your spiel about them a disturbing lack of Paul George and Marcus Morris praise. A couple guys who you have just done nothing but just defecate on, all right? Nothing but slander for those two. And here they are, man. They're stepping up in the big moments. It's now back-to-back games for Marcus Morris where he's been fantastic. It's been back-to-back games for PG where he's been fantastic and a couple of wins. What does this mean for Paul George's redemption? Because let me be clear. Let me be clear, Logan. I may have been frustrated with PG for a lot of last year, and I think the reasons for that were validated in the playoffs. But this year, he has been playing pretty consistently, either the best basketball of his career or right up there with that OKC season. And now he is sustaining that. And yeah, he had a little bit of a dry spell in the playoffs. But as they say in this world, the celebration should be as loud as the apology should be as loud as the slander. Something like that. So that's targeted at you. So apologize to Paul. He's a good guy.
I think you need to give me some toilet paper from defecating on these guys. Look, bruh, like, I guess I'm wrong. Like, yeah, I was wrong about Paul George because I said he sucked. Paul George doesn't suck. We all know that. He's been a great playmaker this season. He can be a great shot maker. He's just been inconsistent. And in a game like this, Paul went up to Ty Lue before the game and he said, T, I got you. I'm doing this. And so I'll give him his props. Paul, PG, you still got a little bit of that dog I knew back in Indiana. You still got a little bit of that in you, and I'll give you your props. You still a dog when you turn it on. I just want to see it more often. To Marcus Morris, I genuinely will apologize, bro. Like, he wasn't hitting his shot, so I'm not going to – I don't feel bad about bagging on him then. This was a really big game, and in the – arguably the two biggest games for LA in this playoff run, Marcus Morris has been there. So while I can – while both guys have been inconsistent, I will give them all their credits. In the two biggest games for them, in the two biggest moments, Marcus Morris and PG showed up, and that does mean something. So I'm sorry to you, Carson. I'm sorry to the audience. I'm sorry to the Clippers.
Thank you.
Maybe I was a little too hasty in just crapping all over this Clippers squad.
Yeah, I think that this has been a nice redemption arc for LA as a whole, particularly if they can close this out, because if they get beyond there without Kawhi, I don't think they're beating the Suns. Like, you can win a best of three game series against a team like Utah. I don't think you're winning a best of seven game series against Phoenix. Although, if CP misses half of it, like, who knows then? We're just rolling the dice. I maybe would take them in that situation. But I think that I have just had faith in the shooting of this Clippers team. And I have had faith that the collapse that we saw last year was a one-off and that it was not some long-term shortcoming. And part of that was that they had Kawhi Leonard and I was never going to count out a team with Kawhi. And part of it was that I think PG has been overly criticized pretty consistently. And yeah, he gave himself a hilarious nickname and I love making fun of it as well. But he's a great basketball player, obviously. And he showed up in a big spot here. And things are gelling for LA right now. So if they do get past this hurdle, man, I pray that Kawhi Leonard is able to come back and that it is not a season-ending injury, because I just don't really want to see a Clippers Western Conference Finals without Kawhi against the Suns, who are missing maybe CP for half the series. Like, that's just not ideal basketball given the quality of teams that we had at full strength this season. And maybe that will be the story of this all when it's said and done, but right now, we are still enjoying some really fantastic basketball. So I'm all in on the PG redemption arc. I think that for the Jazz, you have to reset a little bit here. If you're Donovan Mitchell, you need to maybe take a little bit of a step back and say, okay, I'm only taking good shots here. When they double, obviously, get the ball out quickly. And the Clippers have been rotating well, but that thing just has to move. You have to find the open man somewhere. And I'm not going to force it. And I know that I'm the best player on the court, but that doesn't mean that I have to be the best player every single possession. And sometimes it means just finding the open man, creating the best shot. And I think that that's going to be huge in determining if they can win this without Conley. If Conley does come back, I think Utah would be the deserved favorite. But again, either way, they have to do it twice. The Clippers only have to do it once. And the same can obviously be said for the Sixers now as opposed to Atlanta and the Bucks as opposed to the Nets. And so it's going to be fun, man. I kind of think all three of these are going seven, honestly. And if that does happen, I will be a happy camper. Any final thoughts on all this as we wrap things up?
I want your, like, official, I guess. So what you're saying, if Conley's healthy, you'll take the Jazz. If the Clipper, if he's not, you'll take the Clippers.
Good question, Logan. Very good question. Yeah, we'll go with, I don't know, man. I want to say Jazz in seven. Like, I don't think the Clippers can necessarily do this again, but the thing is they create great shots, and if they create great shots, they're going to make great shots, and that's kind of an inevitability with them. I want to say I believe in the Jazz and all their difference makers and the Joe Ingles of the world having his multifaceted impact and Clarkson being able to get hot on any given day and do it in a variety of ways as a scorer. but I just don't know, man. So, what's yours? Buy me a second here. What's your official prediction?
I think I'm going to go Clippers in seven. Also, I do want to give you props, though, man. Not many people in their brackets that I saw had the Clips going as deep as you did. So, I mean, just if they do get out of this series, it is going to look good on you, dog.
And you know what, man? I'm also proud of the fact that I held out hope. And when they were down 2-0 against the Mavs, I said, I think this thing's still going seven. And so I'm glad. I mean, the Clippers may not be my favorite team to watch, and I understand why people don't like them and why people like to poke fun at them, but they are redeeming themselves here, and they're redeeming me as well after my title pick lost in the first round from their same city. So, you know what, man? I guess I'll go Clippers in seven if Conley isn't there, Jazz in seven if Conley is there. I don't feel great about it, but at this point, it's kind of a crapshoot. It's really just going to be about shooting, and that's a tough thing to predict, but these are a couple of great shooting teams, and then again, maybe it comes down to a battle of the closers, and PG versus Donnie would be a joy to watch in that situation. So, with that, we are done for the day. Cannot wait to see how these last few games play off, and then this will be the last time that we touch base during these series, but we will be back to preview the conference finals, which will be a lot of fun, and reflect on these series as well, because I'm sure that the interesting stuff has not concluded thus far. If you want to enjoy more interesting stuff, well, I recommend a channel and a podcast known as Nerd Sesh. If you're on our YouTube channel, go ahead, stick around, check out some of our video breakdown content, check out a lot of our full podcasts that we post here as well. If you're just listening in audio, then you know where to find us, but it's Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your audio content. You can follow us on Twitter at @nerd_sesh and on Instagram at @nerdsesh. And with that, as always, I've been Carson Brabber.
I've been Logan Camden.
And this was Nerd Sesh.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.